And on that most hallowed of days, July 10th, 1942, the mighty wizard was delivered unto this world, and high upon a starless night sky, a glorious rainbow disc shined, such that all that skulked in evil and ruin was most afeared, quivering and shaking in their damp and moldering places. So began a 67-year reign of truest, heaviest metal. And it was good. Prologue. Wherein our hero arrives upon this most unworthy mortal coil, and grows to discover limitless power concealed within a diminutive frame.
John! This is it!
The one! The big kahuna! The mystical beating heart at the dead center of the heavy metal cosmos! Ronnie James Dio! Can you feel the magic in the air?
I feel something in the air.
Okay. Well, to my mind, it's like a rainbow. A rainbow, but in the dark. Wouldn't you agree? It's a fucking rainbow in the fucking dark.
I don't know how to conceptualize something that requires light to exist in a darkness.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't.
Okay.
All right.
This bodes well.
Yes, it's going to be good. I am very excited. Ronnie James Dio, indeed. Do you have chills?
Not yet.
You're going to have chills. I assure you, yes. Now, we have discussed the tiny man with the massive voice before, but at long last, we are ready to dedicate an entire episode to one of heavy metal's most monumental artists. And it's about fucking time. Sheesh! So, John, whatever do you remember about the late, great Ronnie James Dio?
That feels like season one. Was that season one?
He came up first in season one. He came up in season one and season two.
So, what do I remember? Mm-hmm. He's affiliated with Rainbow.
Hence
the reference you just made.
Sort of. Although, actually, it's not a Rainbow reference so much as a Dio solo reference.
And then he also, does he replace Ozzy in Black Sabbath?
Bravo.
Hey!
Bravo!
I think that might be the first time I've remembered something on this podcast.
This is good. If you're going to remember anything ever on this entire podcast, remember stuff about Ronnie James Dio.
So far, mission accomplished.
Okay, excellent. I feel good. That's exactly right. That said, we did talk about some other stuff, right?
You say a lot of things.
You talk a lot. You are remembering some crucial plot points, and I appreciate this, but you're also forgetting a lot of stuff, which is why we repeat things. Because, to borrow a phrase from the great Messieurs Cheech E Chong, John's head is like a sieve. Okay, so this obviously is the prologue of our epic tale, wherein we shall learn of Dio's origins and early career. But before we do that, I'd like to do something quite a bit different. I'd like to set the mood with a very early listening break. Before I speak on Dio's behalf, I think our hero should have a chance to speak for himself. John, are you ready to break with our conventions and to insert a listening break wildly early into our proceedings?
Sure.
Oh, we're animals! Unpredictable animals. So, before we move any further, let's let Ronnie tell it like it is via one of my own very favorite Dio tunes, the shit-kicking opening track off of the 1984 album, The Last in Line, We Rock. Everybody, pause the podcast, click the first link in the show notes, and let's get fucking crazy and remind the world that we do, in fact, rock. Do it! Rock! Fuck yes! Even John rocks! Now I am even more pumped. John, are you pumped?
I'm so pumped.
You look so pumped! It's such a great tune. Did you like it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's fine. It's just we rock for like 3 minutes.
We sure do. We rock for like an hour and a half sometimes.
We rock for a very long time.
And we do.
We do not rock with brevity.
We keep on rocking. What about that beautiful, beautiful singing voice?
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Sure.
High, but strong.
Yeah.
Clean, but a little dirty.
Okay. Mm. I mean, you're just saying things.
Yeah, I am just saying things. Yeah, Dio. I think it's like the sound of angels. Angels shrieking a glorious heavy metal fire. Something poetical like that. Anyway, I am now ready. Prologue, go! Our tale begins in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on July 10th in the year of our Lord, 1942, with the birth of a legend, Ronald James Patavona. Patavona was raised by his parents, Patrick and Anna, in Cortland, New York. At the tender age of 5, the future Ronnie James Dio began studying the trumpet, an instrument his father was to insist he practice for 4 hours a day throughout his entire youth. 4 hours of trumpet daily. John, what do you think about that?
I think that's the path to future success as a musician.
Oh, you're not planning on having children, right?
Correct.
That's for the best. Good, good.
I also definitely would not encourage my children to be musicians.
No. Big mistake. Yes. Big mistake. Yes. By the time he was a young teenager, Ronnie was already playing trumpet professionally on stage. John apparently
bragged. 4 hours a day is the minimum amount of required practice time to become successful as a professional musician. That's just like what it takes.
You've heard it first here. John is a dick.
That's not a dick. That's just like it takes this much work. It's very hard and competitive.
You heard it here first. Torture your children, according to John.
No, you're hearing me say don't tell your children to be musicians. It's a terrible life choice.
Can I continue?
It's up to you. Are you going to keep fighting me on how many practice hours are appropriate?
You're great. 4 hours at least. Maybe 12. According to his widow, Wendy Dio, quote, he decided that he couldn't pull girls playing the trumpet, so he taught himself to play bass.
That's wrong. That's the wrong switch.
I assume you have some experience in this area.
That's not how that works. Share. That's not the instrument you go to get the girls.
You don't think that bass gets you the play that you would hope for as a teenager?
I mean, I guess, you know, you got to figure out who you're going for. Uh-huh. So I suppose there's a chance that bass is more appealing than trumpet to a certain audience, but that's not the standard move.
Okay. So you think that perhaps Dio was mistaken in that transition if the goal was to please the ladies?
Yes.
Okay. Anyhow. It was in high school, in 1957, that Ronnie put together the first of his many early rock and roll groups, the Vegas Kings, in Cortland, New York, which is neither geographically nor geopolitically close to Las Vegas, but there you go. Perhaps realizing this very thing, by 1958 the band had become Ronnie and the Redcaps, though, for the record, extant band photos don't seem to show any actual Redcaps, so possibly no lessons had been learned after all. Regardless, the band went on to release 2 singles. The first, Conquest, from 1958, was an original instrumental. But in 1960, they released a second single, An Angel Is Missing, composed by songwriters Clint Ballard Jr. and Fred Tobias, featuring one Ronald Dio, nay Patavona, not just on bass, but also on vocals. The bassist and now burgeoning singer had begun using the name Dio in that same year. A surname borrowed from a mafioso tough guy named Johnny Dio. John! Ronnie is now a Dio, and despite no formal vocal training, he is stepping up to the mic and singing. Will the breathing techniques he mastered learning to play the trumpet be sufficient? Will cutting-edge rock and roll circa 1960 be the idiom in which the newly minted Ronnie Dio might truly shine? What's gonna fucking happen, John?
I don't know. Will you tell us?
Actually, here's what's gonna happen right now. We're all going to listen to a really, really old Dio performance. Yay! It's time to pause the podcast once again and step into the way, way back machine so we can hear what 18-year-old Ronnie Dio was up to in his earliest recorded vocal performance. John, why don't you DJ us on into the listening break? That'll be real fun.
All the DJs say, this one's on its way. It's the cream of the crop. It's the thing of the pops. Here's tomorrow's top tune today.
That's right, folks. Up next are the coolest cats from Cortland, Ronnie Dio, and the Redcaps performing their crazy new tune, An Angel Is Missing. Pause the show, click the link, and get cozy with someone you love.
I was not able to put this track on your Spotify playlist because this particular song isn't on Spotify. So you're all fresh and stuff. Thoughts? I'm guessing that this wasn't quite what you were expecting to hear on this storied heavy metal-centric podcast of ours.
Certainly was not heavy or metal.
No? No, I think that's accurate. I mean, the year was 1960, so we're pretty pre-metal.
Yeah. I mean, that was some... what the fuck is the song from Grease?
Beauty School Dropout?
Beauty School Dropout.
Yeah.
Yes, that was very much Beauty School Dropout.
It's totally Beauty School Dropout. Good, good. Yep. Look, the fundamental point that we're underscoring here is that Dio had a long fucking career. The hero of our tale was already making music professionally as a young lad in the late 50s, which is pretty crazy, right?
Sure.
For like a metal dude?
Yeah.
Yeah, so crazy. Now, they say that all that's past is prologue, but it's time for us to move along into the more recent past and to tackle RJD's transition from early rock and roll into early 70s hard rock alongside a collection of fellow really short dudes. John, have I yet mentioned that Ronnie James Dio was quite short?
I don't know that you have on... Well, you made an allusion to it.
I made an allusion.
You did make an allusion to it.
Specifically, 5 feet, 4 inches. Vertically challenged, as they say. I mean, you know...
How tall are you?
I'm almost 5'11".
Oh.
Yeah.
You look shorter than that.
It's because I vibe very small. Just insignificant, if you will.
It's because you're always hunched over.
And I'm always hunched over. Angry. Shaking.
It's the weight of the world.
It is. The weight of the world is heavy on my shoulders. I'll remind you that the vertically challenged amongst us, they once saved Middle Earth, right? From the clutches of sinister Mordor.
How is that the pivot? How is that the, how did we go from...
Because, John...
Dio was short to now we're talking about hobbits.
Much as the hobbits saved their world, Ronnie James Dio was to save this Earth from the clutches of all that was neither awesome nor metal. Eventually.
I feel like, humbly speaking, mission failed.
Oh. He was gone too soon. He wasn't done. You're right. He had more to do. Now I'm getting sad.
All right,
well, let's move along to happier times. We're going to begin to tell that tale in earnest.
Chapter 1. Enter the Electric Elves.
Now, John, I don't much like the band Elf. Does this sadden you?
That's a band?
Yeah, Elf.
Elf?
Elf?
The band Elf.
One Elf, a band.
That's not a great band name.
Do you prefer the Electric Elves?
No.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't, elves don't.
It's just not. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. Well, their particular brand of musical tourism, in which a bunch of short dudes from upstate New York.
No, did they call themselves the Musical Elves because they were short?
That is... accurate.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's some Keebler bullshit right
there.
Yeah,
a little bit of bullshit. The problem here is that though they were from upstate New York, they kind of pretend to be Southern rockers in this project, and that just never has worked for me. But without Elf, there is much extraordinary music we may never have gotten to hear, and they were definitely an important early step in the larger Dio journey. So let's get to know us some Elf, shall we?
I guess if we must.
We must! Okay, John, how's about you tell us a magical story about the wee folk?
Chapter 1 of our fantastical tale begins with the band formerly known as Ronnie and the Redcaps, who would make their way through a variety of further name changes before, in 1967, becoming the Electric Elves.
Whee!
Following a tragic car accident which resulted in the death of Dio's closest friend, guitarist Nick Pantas, the band shortened its name. First, they became The Elves, and in 1972, simply Elf.
Fun fact alert! Elf keyboard player Doug Thaler would one day go on to manage Motley Crue, which anyone who has ever read the book The Dirt would know was a fucking challenging gig. Okay, continue.
Elf would go on to be intimately linked with Heavy Metal 101 favorites Deep Purple, and their eponymous debut album was co-produced by that band's bassist, Roger Glover, and drummer, Ian Pace. Elf were to find some tiny modicum of fame as Deep Purple's opening band, but it would be the particular connection they would eventually form with Purple's brilliant mercurial guitarist, Richie Blackmore, which would prove the most enduring legacy from this period.
elf. Freaking elf. So there are three elf albums. The self-titled from 1972, on which, it should be noted, Dio not only sang but also played the bass, as well as Carolina Country Ball, 1974, and Trying to Burn the Sun, from 1975. Despite the fact that the singing is always great, as a totality, this collection of albums is pretty useless to me. However, once in a wee little... once in a wee little while, the musical clouds part, and we do get an occasional peek into Dio's future musical direction. Generally, however, Elf are really just important as a way station standing between the early rock and roll of Ronnie and the Whatevers and the titanic heavy metal glories that were on the horizon. An important aside here is that Ritchie Blackmore was having ever-increasing difficulties with Deep Purple's Mark III musical direction, and his wandering artistic eye led him to create what was originally intended to be a solo project. Basically, in short, he ended up swallowing Elf up to become the backing band for that project, which will be the very next stop on this epic journey. But first, let me be clear and say that Elf definitely did not suck. I don't personally like their music, but they were an extremely competent band. As I previously mentioned, we do get a peek or two into the much more interesting future of Dio's music making in Elf's music. One such instant occurs on track number 3 of the eponymous debut, the darkly theatrical Nevermore. Let's us use this lovely ditty as a means of transitioning ourselves into the serious business of this episode that is to come. Pause the podcast, click the link in the show notes, and enjoy a dramatic transition as we begin the darker, scarier, more deeply wonderful part of this journey. We'll see you on the other side. John, whatever do you think about this rather early hint at the mighty, majestic Dio we shall soon grow to know and to love?
Well, it's a big leap from the first thing we listened to, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Quite a bit different, yeah. Correct,
but somehow still very musical theater-y.
Yeah, interesting. This is another reason I would expect you to sort of feel an attachment to Dio. He's very theatrical.
Yeah, it's kind of campy.
Yeah.
That was kind of campy.
A little bit campy. Yeah, I like that. I don't got a problem with camp.
I'm sure.
Yeah. It's a good song. Nevermore has just a touch of that je ne sais quoi, which Dio will very soon be bringing to the table as one of the greatest artists in the history of heavy metal. And this makes me happy. John, did it make you happy?
Honestly, that just kind of made me confused, that
okay.
track.
Okay. All right.
It didn't make me mad, so
that's above okay. average. All right. Go, go Elf. Having done the elf thing, this marks an important demarcation point in our epic tale wherein we can finally shed all the preliminaries and enter the truly metallic portion of RJD's magical life. John, we get to talk about heavy metal from here on out. You like it when we do that, right?
I do appreciate it when we do the thing our podcast claims to do.
All right. Then read the next fucking chapter title, would ya?
Chapter 2, Ritchie Blackmore and... Ronnie James Dio's Rainbow.
So, how does one make one's way from a competent, if middling, faux southern rock band to fronting one of the most important bands in mid-1970s heavy metal, led by one of the true titans of that nascent genre, Ritchie Blackmore? This is just the sort of context we like to provide here at HM 101. At least I do. You just say stupid shit. And so in a compelling...
That's why you pay me. It's literally the job description is provide asinine commentary.
You did so well.
Thank you.
You deserve all the money you get.
I know.
Every penny of it. And so in a compelling series of bullet points, John will convey the strange, wonderful, and sometimes deeply depressing tale of how Elf became Ritchie Blackmore's plaything... Rainbow, and how Dio's star, at the comparably not-so-tender age of 33, at last truly began to ascend and blaze with a brilliant, bright, glorious warmth. John, however did Dio and Blackmore join forces? Bullet points, activate! 1!
As previously mentioned, Elf was intimately linked with Deep Purple, as Roger Glover and Ian Paice had attended the band's label audition in 1972 and ended up co-producing Elf's debut album and releasing it in Europe on their very own Purple Records imprint.
2.
Elf became Deep Purple's regular opening act, touring the world with the band at the height of their Mark II and Mark III glory days.
Three!
Roger Glover left Deep Purple in 1973, but continued to produce Elf's subsequent releases. Additionally, he asked Dio to co-write and sing on a number of the songs on his own 1974 solo debut, The Butterfly Ball and The Grasshopper's Feast, including the hit single, Love Is All. At around this same time, things were beginning to get increasingly tense in the Mark III Deep Purple camp. Their first album, Burn, had been a triumph, but new members Glenn Hughes and David Coverdale were not seeing eye to eye with the always challenging Blackmore regarding the band's future direction. These issues came to a head during the 1974 Stormbringer recording sessions, when the band refused Blackmore's request to record a cover song originally by the band Quartermass, Black Sheep of the Family.
Five.
After the subsequent Purple / Elf tour, Blackmore gradually began to court Dio, first hanging out socially and publicly jamming with him, then asking him to join in a solo project to record the aforementioned Black Sheep of the Family, and then eventually coaxing him to co-write an original tune as a B-side to that single, 16th Century Greensleeves. For the recording sessions for these tunes, Blackmore used not only Dio, but all of Elf, aside from guitarist Steve Edwards, as his backing band.
And the stage was set. Dio was like a fly, caught in the much more famous, quite spidery, Ritchie Blackmore's web. But in a good way, I guess. Not great for Elf guitarist Steve Edwards, I suppose. Nor actually for anyone else in Elf, in that Blackmore soon did use them to record the entire first Rainbow album, and then immediately fired every single person except for Dio. So bye-bye, Elf. Hello, Rainbow! Or, more properly, Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow, which was the name placed onto the self-titled 1975 full-length release that was shortly to emerge. John, are you impressed by the sinister machinations of Ritchie Blackmore, who stole Dio out from under Elf's nose and used and then immediately tossed the rest of the band into history's trash bin?
Impressed? No.
No?
I'm not impressed by that.
It's kind of dickish.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. This is pretty slick, though. I mean, it's a very efficient way of, like, you know, taking over somebody's life.
Sure.
It's kind of what I did to you.
Is it?
A little bit.
Is this what's going on?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel that way.
Never mind. Forget I said anything.
Okay.
Now, there are two critical things one needs to know in order to truly understand Rainbow. Firstly, Ritchie Blackmore and Ronnie James Dio were both musical geniuses of the first order, and putting these two dudes together was a recipe for some truly magical music making. Secondly, Ritchie Blackmore is a legendary asshole of the First Order, and anything he touched was bound, eventually, to turn to poop. Got it?
Wait, does that mean in the previous metaphor, you're Blackmore and I'm Dio?
Yeah.
Yay! Hoisted on my own petard. Fucking A. Anyhow. This project eventually proved to be Blackmore's Deep Purple exit strategy, and by 1975, he had officially left that band. For the record, Rainbow was named after a favorite LA hangout spot, the Rainbow Bar and Grill in Hollywood. This is important stuff, so let's take a tour of the Dio / Blackmore era of Rainbow's discography. We've got us three fantastic albums to discuss, starting with that problematically eponymous debut, Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow. Worth noting is that despite that unfortunate sobriquet, all seven of the original songs on the debut album were Blackmore and Dio co-writes, and this album was very much a collaboration between these two dudes. So John, I put the classic opening track, Man on the Silver Mountain, on your playlist. However did you find this delightful tune?
It feels old.
Hmm. Okay.
Like, compared to where we started with Dio in this episode, it is obviously massively in a new direction.
Right.
But compared to what we classify as metal on this show, it's got a riff, it's got distortion, like it's checking boxes, but it just feels like more bluesy rooted.
Yeah, it's fair. It's definitely that early, some might even say proto-metal, kind of classic rock with like sort of all the surface textures of heavy metal, if not the actual oomph.
Yeah.
In defense of Rainbow collectively and even this album, you know, some songs are a little more obviously metal and some songs are a little less obviously metal. But we're really at the early phases of anything that could be collectively called heavy metal in 1975. Mm-hmm, so I think it's a fair point. Now, it is a very iconic opener. And I will note that the phrase, "the man on the Silver Mountain," is actually written on Dio's gravestone. So obviously, this is an important piece from his truly storied career.
Did he decide what goes on his gravestone?
I can only assume so.
Have you decided what's going on your headstone?
Yeah, it says, "fuck John."
Oh.
I know. I thought you'd be honored.
How long has that decision been made?
Oddly enough, since before I met you.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah. Look, it's a really, really great album across the board, and this apparently was Dio's favorite of all the Rainbow albums he participated on. It was released on September 5th of 1975. The aesthetic direction of the music was in part inspired by the fact that Blackmore had recently begun playing the cello and had become increasingly interested in classical and pre-classical harmonic progressions. Simultaneously, this also marks the beginnings of Dio's lifelong lyrical obsessions with a sort of fantasy medievalism, wizards, swords, sorcery, and the like, as heard in a tune like 16th Century Greensleeves. John, why could you give us a little taste of some of those lyrics?
"Meet me when the sun is in the western skies. The fighting must begin before another someone dies. Cross bows in the firelight, green sleeves waving, madmen raving through the shattered night."
Ooh. Modal chord progressions and epic lyrics evoking long gone days of yore.
Is that epic?
Crossbows in the firelight, madmen raving through the shattered night. I mean, it's fairly epic. Whatever. Shut up. So, I mean, here's the thing, John. Do you think that perhaps we are witnessing the birth of a sort of proto-power metal here on Rainbow's debut?
I know you want me to say yes.
You don't know what power metal is. Don't even pretend. Do you?
No, I don't know anything, but I know you want me to say yes.
We are indeed! Anyhow, the album was a hit, charting solidly around the world and peaking at number 11 in the UK and number 30 in the US. Of additional note, it was produced by future Iron Maiden partner in crime, Martin Birch, who had previously served as engineer for a bunch of Deep Purple's classic albums. If I wanted to fully document Blackmore's dickishness, penchant for cruel jokes, and particularly his arbitrary firings of personnel...
Penchant for cruel jokes? You've spent this entire episode making short jokes.
Haven't we already compared me to Richie Blackmore? I am the Richie Blackmore of this ensemble.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you get it. That said, this would take up the entire episode, so let's again just note that everyone but Blackmore and Dio were fired after the recording of the debut, Bye Bye Elf, and that a very different ensemble toured this material. By the time the band went into the studio with Birch to record their sophomore release, Rising, in February of 1976, Rainbow were Dio, vocals, Blackmore, guitar, Tony Carey, keyboards, Jimmy Bain, bass, and Cozy Powell, drums. Rising is probably overall my favorite Rainbow album, most particularly for its world-beating, epic second side, which consists of just two 8-plus-minute epics, Stargazer and A Light in the Black. John, do you by any chance remember listening to those two songs 100 years ago, back when we discussed the best metal albums of the 1970s?
Absolutely not.
I figured as much. It's because you are a stupid, stupid man.
I have a very bad memory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've heard that about you. Anyhow, despite kicking still further ass, Rising kept the band in sort of a commercial success holding pattern, doing really approximately the exact same business as its predecessor. Rainbow then released a cool, jammy, bluesy, metally double live album, On Stage, and Blackmore once again went through a wild cycle of hirings and firings, increasingly stressing Dio the fuck out. By the 1978 release of the final Dio/Rainbow album, Long Live Rock and Roll, the band was in an odd state, with keyboardist Tony Carey getting fired, then rehired, playing on a few tracks, and then getting fired again, and being replaced by David Stone for the rest of the recording session. Blackmore fired Jimmy Bain as well, and first took on most of the bass duties for the recording himself, until eventually bringing the great Bob Daisley in to finish things off. Basically, Richie Blackmore was good for three things: making music, firing people, and vicious, unfunny pranks involving the reckless destruction of property. John, I think that you guys could be good friends. What do you think? I mean, before you answer, you're friends with me. And as the Richie Blackmore in your personal sphere.
Trapped. Serious question relating to this material. At this point, is Dio done being a bass player?
It's a very good question. Yes. I mean, it does come up again in his career a little bit when absolutely necessary. But the first Elf album is really the last album he meaningfully plays bass on.
Yes. Got it.
Good question. Honestly, Blackmore really does seem like he was just a complete dickhead. Sigh. And yet, despite an intensely fractious ambience having settled upon the band, Long Live Rock and Roll would prove to be yet another excellent Rainbow album. Like its predecessors, it was a solid commercial success, charting around the globe and peaking at number 7 on the UK charts. But Blackmore wanted more. He really wanted the band to break big in the massive US market, and on that front, they were moving backwards, peaking at only number 89 this time around. Sad Richie. Mad Richie. Bad Richie. But wait! Before Rainbow shit gets irrevocably stupid, I've got a quick, joyful, biographical diversion to interject. In 1978, Ronnie married the love of his life, Wendy Dio, née Walters, a former Rainbow Bar and Grill waitress who had been previously married to, of all people, John's favorite drummer in the world, and according to some rumors, his father, Ainsley frickin' Dunbar! Yay, Ainsley Dunbar HM101 cameo, even though John is too forgetful to appreciate the significance.
Hey, someone out there will get it.
Someone will.
There's someone who listens to this show and actually pays attention. It's not
it's
me.
It's definitely not
it's
John.
It's not me, but someone does.
Anyhow, Wendy would go on not to be simply Dio's partner in romance, but also his manager. An important figure on the scene. It's a rock star wedding. How nice is that?
Lovely.
That's so nice. And now, back to everything getting fucked. You see, following the world tour supporting Long Live Rock and Roll, Blackmore decided that the most important thing was making moolah and scoring that elusive, massive hit single the band had yet to manage. With Richie wanting to go the full pop music Monty, he decided it was time to move on from Ronnie. Actually, what happened next seems to be a bit muddled, with Blackmore claiming to have fired Dio and Dio claiming to have left of his own volition. Now, more recently, Wendy Dio has been quoted as saying that Richie Blackmore did fire Ronnie for, quote, not writing more commercial songs. Regardless, Dio's time spent basking in the warm glow of Rainbow was done. But don't worry, John. You look worried. You okay?
I'm not worried. I know there's more to come.
Oh, good. You know, Ronnie James Dio, he's going to land on his feet.
Yeah?
Yeah, I promise. Well, on the other hand, Blackmore and the next edition of Rainbow, they're going to finally find a hit single by a fucking terrible cover song called Since You've Been Gone, and then pretty much totally fade from the history of music that anyone remotely cares about. Silly Richie Blackmore.
That can't be the song that comes into my mind when I hear the title Since You've Been Gone.
The Kelly Clarkson song? No. That's a great fucking song. I wish it was that song. Were it that song, I'd be like, yeah, Richie, it was worth it. No, it's just a piece of shit. All right. Very poppy. Before we move along to our next segment of This Is Your Life, Ronnie James Dio, I'd like to know what you, John, thought of the other Rainbow track I put on your playlist. I skipped the material from Rising since you had previously listened to the entire awe-inspiring Second Side, despite having totally forgotten about it like a moron. And aside from The Man on the Silver Mountain, I also included the rather heavy metal Kill the King from Long Live Rock and Roll. How, as a totality, have you enjoyed Catching the Rainbow?
Yeah, I mean, nothing about this music bothers me. The subject matter, I mean, it all kind of fits into that vaguely fantastical realm, which, I don't know.
Some have alluded that this song might possibly be about Dio's increasingly problematic relationship with Blackmore.
Oh, that's fun.
Dio himself claims that it was about chess.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's strange.
A little strange. A little strange. But yeah, I mean, it does seem on the surface to fit into this whole, you know, medievalism and all that.
Yeah.
It's an exciting song.
Sure.
Now, I can't stress enough what an important contribution to the early history of heavy metal Rainbow made. Despite all of the upheaval, the combination of Dio's voice and lyrics with Blackmore's heaviest music making was truly extraordinary, and any self-respecting metal fan must needs to deeply explore all three of the classic Blackmore/Dio era Rainbow albums. But now, John, it's time to say goodbye to one iconic British mustachioed guitar diva and to say hello to another iconic British mustachioed guitar diva. How does that sound?
Okay.
All right. Well, then, turn the page and tell us the title of the next chapter, would you?
Chapter 3. Welcome to Heaven.
And hell.
John, we have already told much of the story of Dio and Sabbath before. Remember?
I do.
Yeah, you remembered that.
This is one of the things I remember.
So nice. Now that is good. An abbreviated refresher for our listeners without John's incredible ability for recall. It's the late 1970s. Porn, bushy mustaches, and shag carpets are everywhere. The future Sharon Osbourne, née Arden, suggests Ronnie Dio as a potential replacement for the recently departed Ozzy Osbourne as frontman for the mighty Black Sabbath. Ione and Dio hit it off like gangbusters, and in their first stab at collaborating, write the utterly iconic Children of the Sea. Complicated bass player hijinks ensue, but eventually A Sabbath 2.0 featuring Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, Bill Ward, and new kid on the block, Ronnie James Dio, record and release one of the most iconic metal albums of the entire 1980s, Heaven and Hell. I don't recall how much I talked about how pissed Sabbath's manager and Sharon's daddy-o, Don Arden, was about this new lineup, but he did famously say, quote, "You can't have a midget singing for Black Sabbath." No, that's not very nice, is it?
Nope. Not an appropriate comment.
Dick. Admittedly, Dio was not tall in stature, as we have said, but he was vast and awesome. And isn't that what really matters?
I guess we'll find out.
Mm-hmm. I want to avoid too much in the way of content redundancy, and just to remind everybody to check out our brilliant Season 2 episode, Everything Old is New Again, Part 1, for a fun-filled, deep exploration of Heaven and Hell era Sabbath, as well as quite possibly the worst musical hot takes of John's storied career. John, you've now got a chance to make amends for not adoring everything you heard from the album Heaven and Hell back then. We're all counting on you. A brief reminder that it was at this time, first stepping into Ozzy's frontman shoes, when Dio developed his use of the iconic devil horns salute, which he had learned as a young child from his Italian grandmother. I'll also remind everyone that late 70s Sabbath had become a total shit show with some bad albums, diminished sales, and lots and lots and lots of drugs. And that the success of Heaven and Hell, which was released on April 18th, 1980, as well as the success of World Tour, completely rejuvenated the band's flagging career. Reminder complete. John, I totally hate to do it, but can we just move this bad boy along and cut straight to Dio-era Sabbath's album number 2, Mob Rules?
Yes.
All right. You like it when I edit, don't you?
I love it when we don't repeat ourselves.
Okay, good. Frankly, I think that pound for pound, Mob Rules is a better album than Heaven and Hell. A large part of that was the replacement of the incredibly amazing, but irrevocably fucked up at that time, Bill Ward on drums with the younger, harder-hitting Vinnie Appice, who I think was a better fit for this era of Sabbath. Like its predecessor, Mob Rules was produced by the aforementioned Martin Birch, and in many respects, Mob Rules simply feels like a further refinement of the pure 80s trad metal sound that Dio-era Sabbath so effectively embodied. It was released on November 4th, 1981, just one day before my 5th birthday, and kept Sabbath well ensconced in its central role in the early 80s metal ecosystem. It went gold in the US and the UK and provided the only actual heavy metal song for the soundtrack of the 1981 animated film entitled Heavy Metal. The Mob Rules. John, are you aware of the existence of said Canadian animated anthology film, which was based on a long-running comic?
No.
Well, now you are, and now you're also aware of the fact that heavy metal, the film, and heavy metal, the musical genre, have basically nothing in common.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of Black Sabbath and perhaps a shared penchant for some fantasy imagery, but that's about it. But I digress. John, I put that title track, The Mob Rules, and my single favorite 80s Sabbath song of all, The Sign of the Southern Cross, onto your playlist. How's about Dio's heart-rendingly gorgeous vocal delivery on The Sign of the Southern Cross?
Yeah, that one stuck out to me more than Mob Rules. That one was more memorable than I went. Both good.
Mob Rules is just like an exciting rave-up. Sign of the Southern Cross is like an epic.
And yeah.
It's flat.
There's a sort of content aesthetic overlap here between the earlier material of Dio and what Black Sabbath is doing that I think makes for a logical pairing.
Good, good. Yeah, I agree. It worked out really nicely, I think, for all involved. I love all of the Dio led Sabbath albums. If there is one criticism of the first two albums that I guess sort of does stick, it's that there really are a lot of similarities between each of them. They were kind of playing it a bit safe with their newly rekindled fame. But look, a great album is a great album, and Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules, they're both great albums. So why did it all end? At least for a while, after just two albums. John, any guesses? Was there perhaps an extinction-level event that wiped out this lineup at their artistic and commercial peak? What do you think?
I don't know. I really don't know. Why don't you go ahead and tell me?
You know, it would have been a decent time to say it was the drugs.
Was it the drugs?
Kind of. On one side, if not the other. Okay, so like so many of these sad tales, it's a bunch of drug-addled he-said nonsense. To be clear, it's drug-addled from Tony and Geezer's perspective. Ronnie was never much at all a user of hard drugs.
Yeah, I don't know why he just strikes me as like a straight-laced guy.
Yeah, he's a pretty straight-laced guy. I mean, he drank, he smoked a little weed, but that was about it. I do sense that his account is a lot more trustworthy than that of the old-school Sabbath fellows. Basically, Dio blamed the disintegration on the band's jealousy, particularly Tony Iommi, about the fact that Warner Brothers had offered him a solo record deal. Between Tony Iommi's anger at this and tensions with Geezer Butler about who should be handling Sabbath's lyric writing, you might recall that in the Ozzy days, Geezer Butler was the principal lyricist,
yes.
Dio wrote his own lyrics, basically tensions were increasingly high within the band, and actually boiled over during the mixing of their subsequent live album, entitled Live Evil, during which Iommi and Butler accused Dio of fucking with the mix in order to highlight his vocal performance. Alas, by the time Live Evil was released in January of 1983, Dio had left the band and had taken Apathy with him. This is why we can't have nice things, John, because you are always too coked up and paranoid, and because my voice is too magnificent to be constrained by any mere assemblage of legendary heavy metal icons. Anywho, this brings us along to our next chapter and the final Ronnie James Dio musical project under discussion today. Do you think you're ready?
Only one way to know.
Then do it, John. Do it.
Chapter 4, When There's Lightning.
You know, it always brings me down, because it's free, and I see that it's me who's lost and never found. I cry out for magic. I feel it dancing in the light. It was cold. I lost my hold to the shadows of the night. Fuck yeah, right?
It's just so nerdy.
It is very nerdy.
It's like deeply nerdy.
It's super nerdy. Yeah, it's awesome. It is very nerdy. I can't refute that. Absolutely nerdy. It's Rainbow in the Dark. Rainbow in the Dark. It's Dio time! And I mean to be clear, it's obviously been Ronnie James Dio time throughout the entire course of this episode. However, it is only now, at long last, when we have arrived at the final stop on this musical journey, the eponymous metal band, to end all eponymous metal bands, motherfucking Dio! So I think we could agree that it is already pretty freaking impressive that Ronnie James Dio went from fronting a fairly obscure 70s rock band, Elf, directly into hugely successful collaborations with some of the heaviest hitters in early metal history. Ritchie Blackmore, and then Black Sabbath. Impressive as career trajectories go, right?
Yeah.
The great F. Scott Fitzgerald.
No one saw that pivot coming. No one.
Welcome to HM101, people. Amen. The great F. Scott Fitzgerald once wrote that there are no second acts in American lives. But we now join Ronnie James Dio on the cusp of his third consecutive musical act of monumental significance. So after things went south with Sabbath, Ronnie decided that it was time to take the plunge and to stop collaborating with mustachioed English guitar divas. He had had quite enough of that, thank you. Instead, with a major assist from his wife and manager, Wendy, Ronnie assembled a band all his own with whom he could make precisely the kind of fantastical, shit-kicking heavy metal he wanted to make. And so in late 1982, that is precisely what he did. John, using your best WWE Wrestling Spectacular voice, please do introduce us to the assortment of musical badass mofos Ronnie collected together to form the classic 80s Dio lineup.
Ladies and gentlemen, please allow me to introduce you to one of the finest bands in the entire history of heavy metal, Dio! On the drums, hailing from rough and tumble Brooklyn, New York, formerly of Black Sabbath, Vinny! My brother pronounces his last name differently than I do, which is pretty weird,
Apucci.
Apucci.
That doesn't look like...
I don't know how to write the phonetic alphabet. Apucci. I like that. It's probably actually... it's probably accurate. Nice Italian from Brooklyn.
Okay.
For the record, his brother Carmine pronounces it a piece.
Wow, they're both wrong.
Apucci.
On bass, the wild and woolly Scotsman himself, former Rainbow bassist Jimmy Bain. And the new kid on the block on guitar, that plucky young lad from Northern Ireland, Vivian Campbell.
And, of course, Ronnie James Dio. Him too. It was, after all, his band. And what a band it was. Bit of the old world, bit of the new. Ronnie was clearly modeling his international cast after what he'd seen work in both Rainbow and Sabbath, and it was to work in Dio as well. Because, John, holy diver. Holy fucking diver. On May 25th, 1983, one of the most significant debut albums in the history of heavy metal was unleashed upon the unsuspecting masses. Holy Diver, the first and arguably the best Dio album of all. Picture it. It's 1983, and you're a young metalhead, clad in your best pair of ripped blue jeans and a black t-shirt emblazoned with the logo of your favorite band, entering the local record store, looking for something that might scratch that very particular musical itch that all of us metalheads know oh so very well. You sidle on up to racks of alphabetized records, and lay eyes upon a glorious LP, festooned with the image of a drowning, chained priest being tormented by a massive, horrific demon. John, could quite literally anything be more metal in all the world?
I mean, I guess like a block of iron?
Really killing my buzz here, aren't you?
Me?
Fun fact, the demon is named Murray. That's fun, right?
Not a particularly demonic name.
I know, it's cute. Whimsical.
All right.
Yeah, I always like that. It's truly a classic cover for truly a classic album. And more importantly, the internal musical contents kick just as much ass as the iconic cover. Ronnie produced, wrote all of the lyrics, and co-wrote all of the songs with various members of the group. This album is Dio through and through, and continued to expand upon the fantasy-themed proto-power metal sound he first pioneered with Rainbow and Black Sabbath. John, in order to give you a goodly taste, I didn't dick around. I put both of the legendary singles, the title track and Rainbow in the Dark, onto your playlist. What did you make of these unhallowed slabs of pure metal perfection?
Decidedly metal.
Oh yeah, definitely metal.
Like big, particularly now having heard that first song. Mm-hmm. Like the musical arc here is broad.
Yeah. Still very theatrical.
Still very theatrical, but now very metal. I liked Holy Diver.
Mm, great song.
Rainbow in the Dark had that weird little synthy string thing happening that was out of place to me.
It's quite iconic, but it's very distinctive.
Yes.
It's memorable.
Yep.
So, aside from being just incredible songs, there are very fun, very period MTV videos for both of these.
Oh boy.
I think our beloved fans need more Dio in their lives. I'm going to do a double, yes, a double assigned video break for this material. Holy shitballs. So everybody's going to pause the podcast. You're going to pull over the goddamn car. You're going to click the links, and you are going to watch in a state of bemused rapture the two paradigm-making video clips. Both Holy Diver, released in August of 1983, and then Rainbow in the Dark, released October of that same year. And John and I are going to do the same thing. All of you can thank me later. Dio! So good. God bless. You were riveted. Tell me you weren't riveted.
Well, I definitely wanted to know what the fuck was going on, that's for sure.
Do you feel like you know what's going on?
No.
No.
Probably not great.
It was pretty fantastic, though. Tell me that wasn't fun. It was fun.
Yeah, sure, that was fun.
It was fun. It was fun. You know, sometimes you do kvetch to me about how the things we're covering, they do not appear to be heavy metal. I think that we can now both agree that there has never been anything more metal on God's green earth than the late, great Lenny James Dio. The listening public, they agreed. Because this debut album charted around the world. It peaked at number 13 in the UK and number 56 in the US, eventually securing an impressive double platinum certification.
Nice.
Ronnie did not need no mustachioed British guitarists. He was doing the thing his way. Dio began that tour cycle opening for a very, very drug-addled Steven Tyler-led Aerosmith. But by the end of 1983, they were headlining in the US with, among others, a young progressive metal band named Queensryche as their opening act. John, Dio had many years of fantastic music making ahead of him, but as we're primarily dealing with just the 70s and 80s today, we've got just one more chapter to go prior to our touching epilogue. But could you lead us into that final chapter?
Chapter 5. They say that life's a carousel.
The classic Dio lineup managed three albums before the inevitable fragmentation began. And until that fragmentation, their star continued to rise. Dio followed up their Stone Classic debut, Holy Diver, with a Stone Classic sophomore album, The Last in Line. These two albums share the same sort of musical kinship which Heaven and Hell and Mob Rule shared, which is to say that Dio had established a successful template with the debut and didn't seem particularly inclined to rock the boat. It doesn't hurt that the title track of the sophomore album is arguably the best Dio song of all, but overall I'd call The Last in Line roughly artistically equivalent to the debut, if perhaps just suffering very slightly from the law of diminishing returns. Basically, we've heard all of this before, but it was fucking killer the first time, so why not do it again? What do you think, John? Do artists need to be constantly innovating, or is it okay if they find their niche and simply stick to it at a consistently high level?
I think both are possible.
Yeah, they're both options, right?
Yeah.
They both have potential
yeah.
pros and cons. The principal difference on The Last in Line was the official addition of a fifth member, Claude Schnell, a keyboardist nay of the band Rough Cut. Rough Cut are a name worth remembering, as Wendy Dio was also managing them at this time, and this is not the last time we'll observe a membership crossover between them and Dio. The band had wasted no time striking while the iron was hot, and they released The Last in Line on July 2nd of 1984. Just a bit over 1 year after the release of Holy Diver. And they had another hit on their hands, as the album would eventually go platinum, peaking at number 4 in the UK and number 23 in the US. By this time, Dio were headlining arenas with an impressive array of early 80s metal opening acts, including, once again, Queensryche, but also Whitesnake and Twisted Sister. In September of 1984, they played on their second consecutive Monsters of Rock Festival, which I would have loved to have seen. Aside from Dio, the West German bills included Van Halen, AC/DC, Ozzy Osbourne, Motley Crue, Gary Moore, and Accept. John, would you have joined me for this extraordinary musical event?
That's a lineup you might could have talked me into.
Ah, good, good, good. Yeah.
So some things I don't love, but a you majority would've... of things I would be interested in.
Yeah, I think it would have been a hell of a show. We would have had much fun, and I think that 80s German metal babes, they would have loved you. They would have like been like all over you.
I don't think that's very kind of you to say.
I thought you'd appreciate that. I'm not a dick. I'm no Richie Blackmore.
Hmm.
Despite
remains to be seen.
Suggestions to the contrary. Anyhow, let's get ourselves a feel for the top shelf music making that Dio were up to at this time. Don't touch me! We're going to take another listening break and check out the iconic title track, The Last in Line. There is a fun-filled video directed by the legendary Phantasm director, Don Coscarelli, but this time we'll go straight audio so that we can all purely worship at the altar of Dio's extraordinary vocal performance. Pause the podcast, click the link, and get on down to the end of the line. We shall see you on the other side. John, you cannot possibly tell me that that is not a fantastic song.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, come on, that transition, that note?
The transition is great. The opening is bizarre. It sounds like someone else.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who, but it gives me a vibe that's not at all what you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And in so making the transition shocking in a surprising and pleasing way, I suppose that is effective.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it's a weird little opening.
Yeah, it's a little weird. It's lovely. It's pretty. It's attractive.
Sure.
And it pays off. I think it just pays off very handsomely. Yeah. I love the riff. The when the metal part kicks in, the vocal is just so intense, so on the edge. The witch. All of it. It just slays. Okay, so we have now reached an interesting juncture in the career of Dio, the band. The career of Dio the man has some seriously epic peaks still to come in the 90s and well into the 21st century, but with their third album, Sacred Heart, and particularly with the titanic Cirque du Soleil-esque tour which accompanied that release, we have, depending on your perspective, either the band's true peak or perhaps the very beginnings of their precipitous decline. Tellingly, it's at Madison Square Garden, at their headlining show for that very tour, that Dio chose to conclude his fantastic autobiography, Rainbow in the Dark, which of course is essential reading for any true blue metalhead. Regardless, Sacred Heart is where things started to get complicated for the band. The general consensus seems to be that this is an album where Dio kind of pulled a Ritchie Blackmore, striking out into increasingly poppy territory in order to appease the glam metal hungry audiences of the mid-1980s. Dio, on the other hand, described this as an especially dark and heavy album, which just happened to particularly prominently feature Claude Schnell's keyboards. I fall somewhere in the middle. There is maybe a bit more pop sheen on Sacred Heart, but honestly, Dio always had sporadic hints of pop metal across their trad metal oeuvre. Just check out a song like Straight Through the Heart from the debut, or that opening of Last in Line we just talked about. It's all there. So that Dio would have elements of pop metal is nothing new, and it all works. Sacred Heart definitely sounds like the year 1985. Songs like Hungry for Heaven are particularly at the poppier end of the Dio spectrum, but overall, it's just a really another excellent Dio album. It's not quite as good as the two albums prior, but it isn't a sellout or anything. It's just plagued by the fact that during the recording sessions, the relationship between Dio and Vivian Campbell was in the process of falling apart due to the young guitarist's increasing concerns that he wasn't being properly compensated for his time and work. In fact, the whole band was really in a state of discord throughout the recording process, and this was bound to result in something of a step down in quality from what had come before. Now, John, are you feeling okay with the compensation and credit we provide for you here at HM101? Because I would hate to think of our working relationship fraying just because I'm the one who hoards all of our money and fame.
I think maybe we should have this talk off air.
Okay. That's great. Anyhow. Sacred Heart was released on August 12th of 1985, and with what was now years of literally constant touring and recording, it really is no surprise the members of the band were beginning to hate each other. However, before we finish up on this period, I have a quick but monumentally important narrative interjection to add. John, are you at all familiar with the legendary, if kind of sort of nearly entirely forgotten, Hearin Aid project?
How is that spelled?
Hearin Aid?
No.
Now, I'm guessing, by contrast, you're at least passingly familiar with We Are the World.
Sure.
All right. I've got an enticing phrase for you. Heavy metals, We Are the World.
Sounds like a bad idea.
Oh, it's metal dudes doing good things for the world, as led by our hero, Ronnie James Dio. How could this not be amazing?
Don't answer that. That was a rhetorical question, John.
Okay, here's the deal. In May of 1985, despite all those internal tensions simmering within Dio, Ronnie, along with guitarist Vivian Campbell and bassist Jimmy Bain, assembled a collection of 40 metal heavy hitters in order to record a track they had written entitled Stars to raise funds for famine relief in Africa. And they named the larger not-for-profit Hearin Aid. Eventually, $3 million were raised as a result of the project, which
is pretty good.
I know, right? Aside from the single and video for Stars, also included a full-length album featuring tracks provided by Accept, Dio, Motorhead, Kiss, and others. The album isn't so easy to track down these days, but the video for Stars can be found on YouTube, and it is a mid-80s heavy metal artifact par excellence. It was filmed in the recording studio, and it neatly demarcates who is singing what and who is shredding at any given time during the literally endless series of guitar solos. getting to see and hear Dio, Rob Halford of Judas Priest, and Jeff Tate of Queensryche trade off vocal leads alone makes this a truly essential watch. But the whole thing is just tons of fun and well worth checking out. So we're going to watch it, and you should too. One last audiovisual break for the episode. It's time to pause the podcast and view this wonderful slab of 1980s metal goodness. Enjoy. John, how fun was that?
That was fun.
It's fun. Sure. It was clearly a different time, right? A
very different time.
Different world.
Very different time.
No doubt. And it was all for a good cause.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, it's time to wrap this chapter up. One of the more fascinating things associated with the Sacred Heart album was the multimedia spectacular concert tour that Dio undertook to support it. Each evening, aside from singing his ever-loving heart out, Ronnie James Dio would slay a massive mechanical dragon with his gigantic sword, and audiences would swoon in rapturous joy. So nifty. And the touring, it all paid off. Sacred Heart was nearly as commercially successful as its predecessors, peaking at number 4 in the UK and number 29 in the US, even if it only certified gold. Still, despite all of those inter-band tensions, I do think it's fair to say that this tour really did mark the climactic peak of Dio, the band's, career. And then, we don't need to go into all of the he said of how and why Vivian Campbell left, but suffice it to say that the relationship between the Dios and Campbell is still, to this day, sufficiently toxic such that Campbell was one of the few really crucial people who didn't get interviewed for the comprehensive and excellent 2022 documentary, Dio, Dreamers Never Die. John, did you see that one?
I missed it.
Oh, it's really good. I recommend it. Highly recommend it. I will say that it was more or less all about money, in that in March of 1986, following the North American portion of the Sacred Heart tour, Campbell was officially out of the band. He was replaced on the next leg of the tour and for the final 80s Dio studio album by guitarist Craig Goldie, nay of the aforementioned Wendy Dio-managed Rough Cut. John, are you sad to see Campbell go?
Sure.
To form a little attachment?
He played the guitar.
You like the Irish?
Sure.
Yeah. John the Leprechaun. great guitarist, really great guitarist. And never fear, Campbell landed on his feet. First, he was one of the Vib Kids members of Whitesnake. You remember that? The guys who didn't play on the album, but they were featured in all the videos. Uh-huh. And toured with the band, so they did make music. And eventually became a guitarist for Def Leppard, with whom he's worked since 1992.
Okay.
Pretty solid gig. I bet you he made his money there.
Probably.
Anywho, in June of 1986, Dio released their first live album, Intermission, which managed to document the conclusion of the Vivian Campbell era over the course of 34 way too short minutes. It's fine, it's just too damn brief. In March of 1987, the new Dio lineup went into the studio to record Dream Evil, their final release of that decade. And while this album is not amongst the most beloved in the Dio canon, it's really still quite good. It's more Sacred Heart good than Last in Line Incredible, but this is yet another high-quality metal album from the master. Dream Evil peaked at a still impressive number 8 on the UK charts and a reasonably respectable number 43 in the US, but this was the first Dio album not to certify at least gold, and that's seldom a good career sign. Dio followed this release with yet another year-long world tour, including such highlights as the 1987 Monsters of Rock concert at Castle Donington in England, also featuring Bon Jovi, Metallica, Anthrax, Cinderella, and Wasp. I think this would probably be a pretty groovy place for us to leave this chronological 70s/80s narrative, like kind of on a high. John, are you good with that?
I'm great with that.
Okay, so nice. There's Dio up on the stage. He's rocking out with an assortment of some of the baddest bands in all the land on a sweaty August day in front of 80,000 screaming British metalheads. I like it. John, as we fade out on Dio and Co. doing their thang on stage, could you please take us along to our final chapter designation of the day?
Epilogue. It goes on and on and on.
That could be like the byline for our entire podcast.
No comment.
Ronnie James Dio was the frontman and a principal songwriter for three of the most important bands in the history of heavy metal. Rainbow, Black Sabbath, and Dio. He is on all right-thinking metalheads' short lists for best genre vocalist of all time. He helped to create perfect, indelible heavy metal anthems like Man on the Silver Mountain, Heaven and Hell, Rainbow in the Dark, and many, many more. Let's not mince words. Ronnie James Dio was the motherfucking shiznatch. John, can we agree on that?
Sure.
Yes. Now, this will most certainly not be the final time that this particular tiny titan appears on our podcast, but I did want to provide just a brief overview of that which was to come in the life and times of RJD. Some bad, some unbelievably great, goodly amount of meh, and eventually, darkest tragedy. John, are you ready for a quick survey of the latter part of Ronnie James Dio's storied career?
Well, I think we could just save it for a future episode, don't
you? Shut up! How do you save this? Gird your loins, buddy. It's gonna get teary. As we shall learn next season, the 90s were a very complicated time in heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
It was the best of times.
It was the worst of times.
It was a particularly tough decade for many of these 80s metal superstars whose careers and reputations suffered greatly with the ascension of grunge. Dio, the band, made a good faith effort to entirely reboot in 1990 with a completely new lineup on the album Lock Up the Wolves. It was not especially well-received commercially, and I'm fairly ambivalent about it myself. But a high school girlfriend of mine was actually a really big fan, so that's got to mean something, right?
Nope.
Oh, okay. For Ronnie, this would be followed by, in my estimation, the single most underrated heavy metal album of all time! In 1992, at what was probably pretty much the true nadir of heavy metal's worldwide popularity, Mob Rules era Black Sabbath got themselves back together and released what would have been a world-beating mega-hit if it had been released at literally any other point in all of human history. Dehumanizer! Alas, while Dehumanizer did make some ripples in the charts, it has never gotten nearly the love it deserves. It's sort of a forgotten masterpiece. And believe you me, friendo, that is something we are going to work to fix next season. You looking forward to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I suspect I'm going to make you angry.
You would never. It's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of fun. It's one of my favorite albums ever. Anyhow, the reunion was short-lived, with Ozzy and more particularly Sharon Osbourne mucking up the already somewhat mucky waters. By the end of 1992, Ronnie was out of Sabbath once again. There would then be five more Dio albums of varying quality with various lineups released between 1993 and 2004. And then, a great and glorious final act. In 2007, Dio and Sabbath got back into the studio to record three new tracks for a compilation entitled, logically, Black Sabbath, The Dio Years. A tour followed, eventually leading to a new album under a new moniker. The Mob Rules lineup of Sabbath became Heaven and Hell. On April 27, 2009, they released the fantastic studio album, The Devil You Know. Another massive tour followed, and not a day goes by that I don't kick myself in the arse for not seeing any of those shows when I had a chance. John, I assume you feel the same?
Yeah. I don't know that they came anywhere I was living.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And now for the final bow. Dio had been suffering from serious stomach pains, and on November 25th of 2009, he was diagnosed with stomach cancer. He made what would be his final public appearance at the Revolver Golden Gods Awards on April 8th, 2010. I actually remember this appearance pretty vividly, and I recall feeling relief that it appeared he was going to be okay. In fact, on May 10th, Dio released a statement saying, quote, "With your continued love and support, we will carry on and thrive. There will be other tours, more music, more life, and much more magic." But this was not to be. On May 16th, 2010, the magnificent Ronnie James Dio shuffled off this mortal coil. We love you forever, Ronnie. John, I'm not emotionally prepared to end with our usual witty repartee, nor to tell the people how to get in touch with us, which they can find in the show notes. Instead, I'd like to do something slightly illegal, but which I think Ronnie would have appreciated. I'm going to let Ronnie sing us out. John, would you be okay if we mildly flaunt copyright law by reposting sound from a live video posted on YouTube in loving tribute to our dearly departed hero?
What are they gonna do?
What are they going to do?
What are they going to do?
What are they going to do? Hell yes! Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for being here, John. Thanks for the music, Ronnie. Here is the late, great Ronnie James Dio, along with Rainbow, live in 1977, singing us off via their gorgeous classic tune, Catch the Rainbow.
When evening falls, she'll run to me like whispered dreams. Your eyes can't see. No, soft and warm, she'll touch my face. A bed of straw against the lace, all there is lace. We believe we'd catch the rainbow by the way, yeah, to the sun. Sail away on ships of wonder. The world was made for you and I.